Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. America has voted, and former President Donald Trump appears headed back to the White House. Trump won the battleground state of Pennsylvania early this morning, closing off Kamala Harris' path to 270 electoral votes. We're talking all about the election today on All Sides, and we begin with the big news out of Ohio. Businessman Bernie Moreno will join Trump in Washington come January. Moreno defeated Ohio's last statewide Democrat, Sherrod Brown, and Moreno helped flip control of the U.S. Senate. Joining me to talk about the most expensive race in American history is Haley B. Miller, politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Haley.
Good to be here.
Hope you got a little bit of sleep last night.
A little.
And here in studio is Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Willing to bet that perhaps collectively between us, we have less than 10 hours of sleep.
Unfortunately, I have very young kids, so I'm experienced.
Same. So let's talk about the Senate race. Sherrod Brown told reporters he could win if Trump took Ohio by 6 or maybe even 7 points. Andrew, it turns out Brown might have been right. He won about 6% of Trump's supporters. Trouble is, Trump won Ohio by 11.
Yeah, that was... We've talked kind of before this election, and a lot of people like me were looking at what that margin would be for Trump. And obviously, the better that he did, the worse it'd be for down ballot Democrats like Brown. And, you know, the converse was true. And that's what we saw last night. I mean, Brown benefited a little bit from the Libertarian candidate, Don Kissick, siphoning off around 3% of the vote. My opinion, it's not really, provable at this point, but I suspect that was votes that he took from Moreno. But obviously wasn't enough for him to come through the finish line. And I mean, if you look around the state, he did pretty well for a Democrat in some areas. We were talking off air, the Mahoning Valley is a good example. But among other things, Trump's margin, low turnout in urban areas, just a whole bunch of things went wrong for Democrats last night. And it was too much for Brown to overcome.
Yeah, Moreno spent the closing weeks of the campaign driving around Ohio in a bus with Donald Trump's face on it, leaning into the idea that a vote for the former president would also be a vote for him. He actually didn't spend a ton of money on ads that defined who he is as a person, mostly focusing on his endorsement by Donald Trump. Haley, that turns out to have been the right bet, no?
Yeah, I think there was a question in the final weeks of this race as to whether Moreno had done enough to tell his story. He really just relied on that Trump endorsement and talked about a lot of, you know, policies that are in line with Trump and what Republicans are expected to do come January now. And, you know, it worked out. I think last night proved that Trump is still very popular in Ohio, even more popular than he was 4 years ago. And so if you're a Republican, it's the right call to be on Trump's side.
Yeah. Moreno also gave his victory speech last night. We're going to play a little clip of it now.
This is a new dawn of Republican leadership. With President Trump and J.D. Vance in the White House, we are going to advance an agenda that is an American agenda. An agenda that says we are pro-immigration, but not pro-invasion.
Andrew, how much do you think immigration factored into this race here? I feel like that wasn't, I don't know. Here in Ohio, I don't know that that had the same sway, say, in Arizona or New Mexico.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think is more of a cultural signifier, although you definitely, at campaign events, hear voters connect the border issue with Ohio's, addiction problems. And so, you know, I wouldn't totally dismiss it, but I do think that if you just kind of look at what voters said was most important to them, the economy ranked really high, and the fact that, you know, you saw different kinds of voters in different places across the country vote for Trump in ways they wouldn't before. I mean, I think something like, like I said, the economic concerns that are kind of similar for everybody across the country, I think that's probably, you know, more of a driving factor. But the way that the immigration issue did affect this race is you saw Democrats across the country, including Sherrod Brown, really run on the defense on the issue. I mean, Brown went from he gave a, it was a bad soundbite essentially, but he was doing a national TV interview, I think in December 2022 or 2023, where he described illegal immigration as being, you know, oh, I don't hear about that. It's mostly a right-wing issue. And then you saw him basically campaign on the bipartisan immigration deal that Democrats passed with some Republicans and just got blocked. So I think it was really a defining issue on the race in that regard, but I don't think it was ultimately what decided it.
Sherrod Brown has had a long career in Ohio politics, serving as our Secretary of State, a member of the House, and our U.S. Senator since 2007. Here's what he had to say last night.
We believe that all work has dignity. We always will. We believe in the power of people over corporate special interests. We always will. We believe if you love this country, you fight for the people who make it work. We always will. This is a disappointment, but is not a failure.
Haley, this brings to the end of a long career for Sherrod Brown. He said that he is sad, but he is never giving up. What is next for Ohio Democrats? I sort of wonder, do they give up on statewide office?
I asked House Minority Leader Allison Russo about this last night, how she perceives the state of the Democratic Party in Ohio. And she's still confident that Democrats win on the issues in Ohio, pointing to things like last year's abortion vote, legalizing recreational marijuana. I think the challenge for Democrats is figuring out how to convey to voters that the policies they like are the policies that Democrats support, and they have not been doing this successfully for several elections now. And all the while, Ohio has continued to get more red, has doubled down on support for Republicans like Trump. So I do think Democrats face an uphill battle in 2026 when they're going to try to claim the governor's mansion.
Yeah, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the bench here in Ohio, because I think that's one of the biggest questions outside of Sherrod Brown, who runs for statewide office. But I do want to dive into some of the county returns just a little bit, because I do think they speak to a broader realignment of voters across the country. Andrew, Brown narrowly lost Mahoning County, an area that used to be a stronghold for Democrats. He also lost in Trumbull, Ashtabula, Wood, Ottawa. These are all places that he used to carry. Is this a signal that working class voters, working class white men, what you might even think of as union workers, are realigning who they vote for?
Yeah, I think that's kind of, that trend has been going on for a while. If anything, I think Brown's performance in some of the areas you described, Mahoning Valley, Northern Ohio, like Erie County and Sandusky, that area, he actually did pretty well for a Democrat. I think that that's almost the best that Democrats could hope for in those regions, because not only have those areas voted for Trump, but they're also trending in favor of Trump. So I think there's some cultural push behind it, whereas sort of the opposite is true in the Cincinnati area and the Columbus suburbs. So what was really interesting, though, to me was that I haven't completely absorbed the results. But if you look at some of the statehouse races in the Cleveland area, for example, in some of the heavily black districts, you saw the Republican candidate pulling like 15% of the vote, and they're basically names on a ballot. Those are areas where those candidates have no chance of winning. But, I think that there's going to be the sort of story of Trump's previous success had to do with these former union areas. But you also saw, both in Ohio and across the country, signs of Trump doing better in urban areas with minority voters, you have to assume. I mean, we'll see the exit polls. So that's just a really stark way that I think the election last night was different than sort of what we've seen before from Trump since he's become a national figure in politics.
Yeah, Trump also won Mahoning County for the second time. Hillary narrowly won it in 2016, but now Trump has won it twice. He becomes the first Republican to win the county twice since Herbert Hoover. So it's been a minute since the Mahoning County solidly went for Republicans. Haley, I also want to talk about Delaware County here in central Ohio. Brown narrowly lost Delaware, so it's getting increasingly more purple.
Yeah, Delaware is a really interesting county, and it's one that Brown focused on pretty heavily. Democrats see an opportunity to make gains there you know, it's a suburban area. We've seen Democrats do better in the suburbs since Trump came into the political sphere. Moreno still won Delaware County. Brown wasn't able to, you know, get over that line last night, but, you know, he certainly did better than Democrats have done in Delaware in the past. So it'll be interesting to see what Delaware County looks like in 2026, especially as Central Ohio continues to grow at the very rapid rate that it is.
And if you kind of compare the results to 2020, Delaware County voted like 53% for Trump. It was maybe it's like 52. It was slightly behind Trump's number that year. But for Brown to narrowly lose it when, you know, the top of the ticket Republican won by like 10 points or whatever it's going to turn out to be, kind of shows that the trend that's happening there. Even though, so the distance between the top of the ticket and that county it's changing.
Trump won Ohio handedly, but we still ranked third in the nation for election spending this cycle, coming in just behind the battleground states of Michigan and Pennsylvania. NPR estimates that $731 million was spent here. Bernie Moreno took a little bit of a swipe at some Democratic spending in his partisan primary.
And Chuck Schumer, if you're watching, thanks for the help in the primary for your fire, buddy.
Andrew, $731 million, and that's the money we know about. That's a lot of money for a single U.S. Senate seat.
Yeah, I think this will kind of branch. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves with what we're going to be talking about, but money matters in politics. Bernie Moreno is somebody that was not known statewide at all. Democrats kind of ran the typical playbook of, in politics, trying to define your opponent, and so they went up on air before Moreno did because of the money that they had to spend. And so you did see that voters did distinguish between Trump and Moreno. They spent few hundred million dollars to do that and still lost the race. And so, nationally, Democrats outspent Republicans. I mean, we had issue one here drastically outspend the opposition, and it did not decide the race. So it's, I guess, one of the takeaways is that money matters, but clearly it's not the only thing, because otherwise, we'd have a very different result last night.
We're going to talk about issue one in just a couple of minutes, but first I want to talk about the presidential election. And I will say both Trump and Harris are expected to address the nation today. WOSU will bring you live coverage of their speeches when it happens. So, Haley, Trump is headed back to the White House after an early morning victory in Pennsylvania, which means I'm going to ask you about our upcoming race to replace J.D. Vance in the U.S. Senate. Nothing like talking about 2026 on the day after 2024. But Haley, do you have any predictions on who Governor DeWine might appoint to fill that seat temporarily in the next couple of weeks?
I feel like people have been speculating about this since even before Vance got the VP nomination in July. We've heard, you know, State Senator Matt Dolin, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, they ran against Moreno in this year's primary and are both interested in the job. DeWine endorsed Dolin in the primary, so I think there's a pretty open question about whether, you know, he would pick Dolin again. DeWine is really focused on electability. Whoever gets this appointment is going to have to run in 2026 and potentially 2028 as well. So the ability to win is important. I've also heard Jane Timken's name thrown out there. She previously was chair of the Ohio GOP, and if DeWine appointed her, she would be the first woman to be U.S. Senator in Ohio, which could also be a good legacy move for DeWine.
Andrew, any predictions on who might get the Senate seat come January?
I mean, my favorite prediction is Jane Timken, kind of for similar reasons that Haley mentioned. I think that she also has some personal wealth and connections that would allow her to. I mean, the kind of model for Republican candidates increasingly is to self-fund, although I don't think there'll be any shortage of money spent in that race. But that's a plus. She has a relationship with soon to be President Trump. And so, but you know, she did run. When she ran, she only got a pretty low percentage of the vote. So I don't know about the electability question there. So I don't know. I kind of almost expect that it will be somebody that we're not really thinking about.
A dark horse candidate, always a good choice.
The names that Haley mentioned are those that you hear the most frequently.
Yeah. I also want to ask, Sherrod Brown made the decision not to attend the Democratic National Convention this summer. He made a decision to separate himself from the Harris-Walz ticket. He did better than the Harris-Walz ticket, but turnout in Cuyahoga County was about 10% below the rest of the state. So, Andrew, let's do a little Monday morning quarterbacking. Good call, bad call.
I mean, his options were pretty limited. I think his campaign ran a really, really cautious strategy. I don't know that, you know, you do hear some second guessing from Democrats about that. Not that, again, with what happened last night, I don't know that there's any perfect campaign was going to be able to outrun those tailwinds. But yeah, so they brought in Bill Clinton to do a campaign appearance for Brown at the last minute in Cleveland. They rented out the Wolstein Center, which is where it's on Cleveland State University's campus. The Cleveland Cavaliers minor league affiliate plays there. I think it has like a 9,000 person capacity. There were a couple of hundred people on the floor. Haley was there too. I think the fact that they sent Clinton in showed that they were concerned about turnout in that area. The fact that nobody really showed up kind of sort of reinforced that. You know, there's some risks to Brown distancing himself from the top of the ticket so much. You know, one of my colleagues, Nick Castell, kind of picked up in Cleveland that some of the Black Democrats there kind of felt like that was a slight for him to not go. I think that there are questions about the lack of a presidential campaign infrastructure here meant that, you know, even though Harris didn't stand a great chance of winning Ohio, clearly, that's kind of who Democrats wanted to turn out and vote for. And the fact that they didn't really have a way to channel the enthusiasm that most Democrats were feeling, I think, was probably a negative. Although, again, it's just kind of such a difficult needle to thread. I just don't know that there's a perfect strategy that meant that Brown would have won the race or anything like that. But there are questions. That's some of the Monday morning quarterback things to think about.
Coming up, we're talking about the congressional races in Ohio and what redistricting will look like going forward. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Republicans expanded their control of state government in Ohio last night, winning all three races up for grabs on the state Supreme Court, ousting the last Democrat in the Senate, and defeating an amendment to change how redistricting works. Still with me to talk about the night is Haley B. Miller, politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, and Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide. A bit of a bright spot, Andrew, for Democrats last night was their three incumbents in the U.S. House seem to have won. Greg Landsman held on to his seat in Cincinnati pretty comfortably. You know, we talked about the realignment of the Mahoning Valley. I sort of see this seat down in Cincinnati, once held by Steve Chabot, is now solidly Democratic.
Yeah, I think he basically recreated Biden's number in 2020. We'll know more about the national picture, but it seems like Democrats did all right in the suburbs. They just kind of needed, and sort of the theory of their race was that they were going to like drastically outperform in the suburbs. And it appears to me that they were dragged down in other areas. But yeah, Landsman got reelected down there. The Cincinnati suburbs, it looked to me as if the Democratic statehouse candidates outran the indexes a little bit. So that's sort of one of the trends for Democrats that they're going to have to try to cultivate. But yeah, Landsman, you know, he was pretty outspoken in criticizing the student protests on college campuses about the Israel-Palestine issue. And, you know, I think that his district reelected him, and he managed to kind of to hold it down there.
Haley, Amelia Sykes won what was expected to be a very close election in the Akron area, but it looks like she did pretty okay considering.
Yeah, I think that race became less competitive as Kevin Coughlin struggled to raise money. And, you know, Amelia Sykes is a known, very known politician in the Akron area, and I think she was able to capitalize on that in the end. So take that for what you will. But I do think, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, money is not the only factor in a race, but it certainly can help or hurt a candidate.
Yeah, Sykes outraised Coughlin pretty significantly. And finally, Marcy Kaptur appears to be hanging on to her Toledo seat. This was the closest race in Ohio last night, just a couple thousand votes between her and Republican Derek Marin. Andrew, she hung on while Brown did not.
Yeah, I was just squinting at the election results. It looks like it's about 1,200 votes that she won by.
Very close.
And 14,000 votes, almost 14,800 went to the Libertarian candidate Tom Pruss, who there was definitely a kind of like a memo that went out in the Democratic Party to try to kind of boost him as somebody who, again, could potentially pull off independent right-leaning voters. So that's, I think it's pretty clearly that he was a spoiler effect in the race. You know, Kaptur issued a statement last night declaring victory. I don't know whether Marin has done the same. That's probably in the recount territory. There's some outstanding absentee ballots. So it's just super, super close. But all the kind of hedging out of the way, Kaptur clearly showed an ability to survive politically in an area that is trending for Trump. You mentioned that Cincinnati is kind of trending in favor of Democrats in the Toledo area, you know, in sort of like the Sandusky area that's adjacent to it is the opposite. And so that's a pretty big win for Democrats.
A big defeat for Democrats last night was Issue 1. The constitutional amendment to take our elected officials out of the redistricting process failed to pass. Haley, it followed the presidential race rather closely. Do you think Trump made a difference? He did come out against it. I mean, but he didn't cut an ad for it. Actually, there wasn't many vote no ads. And yet, it looks like it's losing by double digits in the end.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much Trump moved the needle. It probably didn't hurt. What I think was more of a factor is the fact that, you know, voters, if they don't understand something, they're likely to vote no on it. And we saw a lot of confusion over this issue, over the ballot language. House Minority Leader Allison Russo put the blame squarely on the ballot language and said that Republicans basically rigged the game to confuse voters into opposing it. Whether voters were sitting at the polls reading through the ballot language is an open question, but I do think it was such a complicated amendment and there just wasn't, I think, you know, the no side was able to cast enough doubt onto it.
Yeah, the old adage is yard signs don't vote. But in this case, I wonder if yard signs messed with the vote. Both the yes on issue one and the no on issue one campaign said voting their way would prevent or block gerrymandering. So I think you're right. I think when people are confused, they vote no.
Yeah, and I was just looking at the numbers, actually. So it failed by 7 points. It did a little better than, you know, than Kamala Harris did. But there were like 200,000 to 300,000 undervotes compared to different top of the ticket races, even though I think issue one was the first thing that appeared on the ballot. I mean, I know I heard anecdotally from people I know who were just trying to sort through the pages in counties with paper ballots, trying to figure out where they're even supposed to vote. Yeah. You know, and if you look at the title and some of the language, the ballot language basically describes it as repealing gerrymandering protections and imposing new gerrymandering requirements. And if you actually talk to Republicans surrounding the effort to defeat it, I think they, you know, I mean, there's agreement among the allies on both sides that the ballot language hurt it. You know, Republicans view their ballot language as accurately informing voters. You know, Democrats have
the Ohio Supreme Court ruled that way.
Right. But Democrats have a different take. But it's just, yeah, it's hard to argue that that the ballot language didn't have a negative effect on the outcome.
This summer, Governor Mike DeWine suggested we consider drawing our district lines the way Iowa does. We got into this a little bit during our Untangled series on redistricting here at WOSU, but DeWine had said, win or lose, he wanted to talk about the Iowa plan. Andrew, do you think that goes anywhere now?
I wrote that in my kind of like notes of things to follow up on last night.
Same.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's probably going to be in the same file as his gun reform plan that, you know, stalled in the state legislature. But you know what that was? Essentially, DeWine in August floated putting up an alternative measure. I mean, Republicans are really worried that issue one is going to pass. I think that there was a common belief that it was going to pass. As the election approached, there was more uncertainty, but I still think they thought it was going to pass. And so DeWine had suggested as a way to get voters to defeat it would be to give them another option. I guess, you know, some voters might be confused about which one was which and stuff like that. But yeah, I would not hold my breath for that thing to come back. But the question for me is, are the groups that fund these things, are they going to look at Ohio as a lost cause? You know, it is, we've seen in the past that when liberal groups wrote off Ohio politically, there was consequences, and they started kind of putting their toes back in the water after the abortion measure last year. So will they try this again? I mean, maybe it would have more success in, when there's not a presidential election going on that will politicize it and bring out a bunch of voters who aren't thinking about it. But at this point, you know, that's just it's hard to there's no answer. But it's an interesting question about how much these groups that fund these things are going to look at Ohio again in the future.
Yeah, I actually asked Senate President Matt Huffman about it last night, and he had a take that redistricting passes in Ohio when both parties agree on what the changes should be. That's what happened in 15 and 18. But this was the fifth time we were voting in 20 years. A lot of those previous iterations where a single party was in support just didn't get over the finish line. So who knows?
Yeah, the sort of ads this year were different in that they just described it as a Democratic power play. They had Donald Trump come out. I mean, that's going to be a strategy we see more and more. I mean, it used to be that you would, in Ohio, kind of run in the primary and then go to the center to try to get the crossover voters. But you can just basically run a Republican campaign like from start to finish. But otherwise, the other messages they used against issue one, talking about the commission and how it would be guaranteed money and how you couldn't, the public could not
weigh in.
Yeah, remove anybody from the office. There were limits on the ability they had to comment on it. That's kind of similar to what you saw before. The Republicans in the past have defeated these by describing the panels being a bunch of unaccountable bureaucrats. So that's a flavor that we've seen before. And, you know, but yeah, it's obviously times have changed when it comes to the general politics in Ohio.
One potentially bright spot for Democrats in Ohio at the state house was they flipped a couple of seats here in Franklin County. A Senate seat went for Beth Liston, which we kind of expected. There were two in the House. Crystal Lett and Mark Sigris picked up seats. Haley, this means there are no Republicans representing Franklin County. I mean, you kind of expect that, but at the same time, this is the first time that they've been completely shut out, especially with Sheila Favor winning in Franklin County as well.
Yeah, the Democrats party in Columbus last night, there were a lot of interesting contrasts going on. Obviously, Senator Brown had a tough night. The failure of issue one was a loss for Democrats, as were the Supreme Court races. But Franklin County Democrats had a lot to celebrate. And, you know, they acknowledged the differences there and kind of presented themselves as the solution to growing Democratic support in Ohio, invigorating the base. Central Ohio, you know, as I mentioned earlier, is a growing area. And so this region will probably get more blue over time, but whether that, you know, translates to the rest of the state is very uncertain, obviously, especially after last night's result.
Yeah. Andrew, you know, one of the things I think about, so I used to work in Colorado. And Colorado, not too long ago, was a red state. They actually got the nickname the Hate State for passing one of the first bans on gay marriage. But now they're pretty solidly blue because Denver got so big and so blue that it overwhelmed the rural red parts of the state. Thing is, they got so big and so blue because so many people from out of Colorado moved to Colorado. That doesn't seem to be what's happening here. It's more like everyone from around Ohio is moving to central Ohio.
Yeah, there's some kind of like immigration trends about places like Ohio actually bringing in outside people because of areas of the country that are really expensive to live. Ohio has a lower cost of living, and so that's kind of, there's a population kind of pipeline that flows here. But yeah, I mean, if Democrats are just waiting for the population trends to work in their favor, you know, recently the state issued a study finding that Ohio will actually lose population by 2050, although it projected an increase in population in the Columbus area. I'm no statistician, but I ran some numbers on that, and had politics to remain exactly the same for the next 30 years, Joe Biden would have picked up like 1% of the vote based on, you know, more people in Franklin County. So that's just not enough to solve their problems. But, you know, Alison Russo is interesting. I think, you know, she's somebody that people have described as possibly running for statewide office. She's basically acknowledged that she's thinking about. And so if you want to have a story to tell, we've seen Democrats in the past say that, you know, things are working in Franklin County for Democrats. We know how to win. So let's like take that approach statewide. But it's just so early in this process. It's just, you know, we'll see where Democrats kind of what their autopsy is in this election, how they chart their path moving forward.
Finally, let's talk about the Republicans who swept the three races for Ohio Supreme Court. That puts our highest court firmly in conservative hands. It will now be six Republicans and one Democrat. Haley, I think it's safe to say putting partisan labels on these races have certainly tipped them in favor of Republicans.
Absolutely. And the Republicans knew that while they were pushing for this. I think, you know, being on the ballot with Trump, as it was for Marino, was a big boon for the three Republican candidates for Supreme Court. And now, you know, this court will be tasked with looking at the state's abortion laws and determining what is or is not unconstitutional under the Abortion Rights Amendment, which was a big reason that Democrats wanted to try to flip control of the court. And last night was obviously a big loss on that front. So I'm very curious to see how a lot of these lawsuits over the state abortions laws will play out. We know the 6-week ban has been deemed unconstitutional officially, but there are still things like the 24-hour waiting period, the law surrounding Down syndrome diagnoses that a very conservative court is going to be interpreting.
Yeah, Andrew, when we had the three Republican justices on all sides before the election, they all described themselves as, you know, strict constructionists, originalists, which essentially means they're looking at exactly what is in the Constitution, no more, no less. But, I mean, the Constitution talks about protection of women's health. It isn't incredibly explicit on certain parts, and it's kind of going to be up to them to determine what that all means.
Yeah, the language of that amendment was, I think, intentionally written to be expansive. I mean, maybe they're even hoping that they'd have a friendlier court interpreting it in the future. But it does give a lot of latitude to judges who want to look at it and decide what it actually means in practice. There is jurisprudence that exists, you know, over time. I mean, under the Roe v. Wade legal regime, obviously a lot of various restrictions were imposed and kind of developed over time, too. And so I imagine that this is very nerdy, but as we kind of in this post-Roe landscape, as we see courts in various states, including those that pass measures like Ohio, interpret these things, I imagine we'll have some more clarity on where, you know, conservative judges and I guess constructionist judges view the lines. But yeah, that's something that's going to have to play out over time.
And just a reminder that we are waiting for President-elect Trump and Vice President Harris to speak. When they decide to talk and address the nation, we will go live here on WOSU. I want to say thank you to Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide. Thanks for getting up early with me.
Hey, it's what I do.
And Haley B. Miller, politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, a history professor is going to help us put this historic election into a little bit of context. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Donald Trump is headed back to the White House with a Republican-controlled Senate. The U.S. House hasn't been decided yet, but it's looking like Republicans could control the federal government come January. Joining me now to help us begin to put this historic election into context is David Stebbin. He's a professor of history and law at The Ohio State University. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Anna.
Yeah. James Carville famously said, "It's the economy, stupid." And I think last night's election may have proved him right on that point. Exit polls showed economy was top of mind for swing state voters, a majority, 7 out of 10 of them, telling pollsters the country was on, quote, the wrong track.
Right. And it's interesting. Former President Trump, soon to be President Trump again, has run three times. And the thing that was new in terms of the economy and issues was the fact that the overall price level had jumped about 20% over the previous 4 years. And there are different things that can get more expensive, but food and gasoline and housing, both rental and buying, those are things that affect people with ordinary incomes a lot. And so that helped him hugely. He also, his two traditional issues, the things he's never changed on since he began talking about public policy in the 1980s, were trade and immigration. And all three of those things, and in the minds of many voters, they're all sort of related somehow, helped carry him. And I say that because at times he lacked message discipline. He said things he shouldn't have. And when I say that, I'm just echoing his own advisors who were very nervous that letting Trump be Trump might somehow defeat him. But the point is those issues and the fact that the opponent did not have the usual amount of time to organize a campaign, develop themes, and all the rest. I mean, she did a great job, given the 3 months that she had to work with. Raising $1 billion in 3 months is a huge achievement and so on. And she had a lot of message discipline. But she essentially had the disadvantages of incumbency without the advantages. So we have the result that we have today.
Yeah, I know there's going to be a lot of think pieces in the coming weeks about who did what and when, but I wonder if one of the big takeaways is going to be that President Joe Biden may end up being known as the guy who didn't know when to walk away.
Right. In retrospect, his decision to stay until it was no longer feasible to have a real contest meant that the Democrats had to do something they had not done since 1968. Which is pick someone who didn't go through the primary process. And the primary process is much maligned, in part because the primary voters are not a representative subset of all Democrats or the larger electorate. But the point is, they do test the effectiveness of politicians seeking to run for president in various ways. In particular, do they have a compelling message? She had run once before in 2019, 2020, but she didn't have a compelling message. She's a very smart, very skilled politician. But at the national level when she ran, and she dropped out before the primaries, she did not really envision having to do this until July. And then, of course, because there was so much opposition to sending President Trump back to the White House, her coalition was unusually broad. Everyone from AOC to Liz Cheney. And so even if you have a compelling vision in your head, articulating it clearly when your coalition is that broad is really hard to do. So I don't fault her in some sense. In other words, I think she ran, given where she started, she actually did a good job, but the deck in some ways was stacked against her. And President Biden is responsible for that. But, you know, there are a lot of older people who feel good and want to keep doing what they're doing. And if you're basically a workaholic, which Joe Biden is, that I don't think that kind of person transitions well to retirement. So what surprised me was that his wife, the first lady, Jill Biden, and family didn't talk him out of running again. So maybe they tried to and didn't succeed.
Trump made pretty significant pickups in the Latino community. He also picked up Black men, particularly in the state of Georgia. I wonder what your takeaway is on how the country's politics have shifted over three straight elections with Trump on the ballot.
Right. Well, no community is a monolith, but it is true that there are a lot of Latino men who have grown up imbued with rather patriarchal ideas about social organization. And you can talk to Latina women and they will confirm this. And so the notion of a woman president for some of them may have been a heavier lift. In some ways, this outcome is more like 2016 than 2020, right? And not just because Trump won, but also because he had a woman as his opponent in those two races. So that's part of it. But he also, a lot of Latino men are sort of working class or blue collar, whatever term you want to use. And Trump, in his own way,
has strong appeal.
Right, exactly. In part because he's old enough to remember when working class males in large numbers held well-paid jobs that enabled them to support families. And there is the appeal of that idea with a certain segment of the younger male population is really strong. So there's a kind of a back to the future quality to his message, and that part of it appeals.
Yeah, exit polls showed the education divide has continued to grow in this country, meaning those without a college education are increasingly supporting Trump. Those with college educations continue to vote for Democrats, which is a real shift. It seems like the Chamber of Commerce, moderate Republican, Mitt Romney style is dead. And so may be the blue dog Democrat like Sherrod Brown.
Right. Well, Sherrod Brown was disadvantaged in that he was in a strongly pro-Trump state seeking re-election. So if Trump's margin gets wide enough, I think the general rule of thumb among the pundits who specialize on Ohio politics was that if Trump's margin in Ohio was 10% or more, Brown couldn't persuade enough people to cross over. And that's what happened. He's a very effective public servant. He's been around for a long time. He was something of a miracle man in his ability to survive in election cycle after election cycle. But the wave of votes for Trump was sort of too much for him this time.
Same for John Tester in Montana.
Right. So it is changing who's in the Democratic Party. The real problem for the Democrats, by the way, with depending overly on college-educated people is there aren't enough of them to be a national majority. But it's also true that politics is driven by people who are the most aggrieved, the most determined to change things. And the quality of life in some ways for working class people in this country has gone down a lot.
Even middle class people. I mean, I have friends all across the country who, you know, my husband and I personally, we eat out less than we used to.
Right.
We're being more cautious about our spending. My grocery bill turns my stomach.
Right. Well, and one of the charming things I heard on the news last night in its sort of simplicity but appropriateness was how much the cost of a loaf of bread has gone up in the last 4 years. And that, again, there are a lot of Democrats who understand these issues. But the donor base of the Democratic Party often is not very focused on the cost of a loaf of bread. And so I have talked to Democratic Party officials, and one of them said, we really get this, especially for heartland voters. But the donor base is coming from a completely different direction, especially the ones in Northern California or the Northeast. And so, again, we sort of struggle to come up with a clear, coherent message for working class people living in the heartland, even if we sympathize with their situation.
Yeah, you got to be careful trying to tell someone, well, hey, inflation has come back down, which it has. It's about 2%, which is where you want it to be.
Right.
But we haven't had deflation. That's a whole conversation about how economics work. So the prices haven't come down. They're very unlikely to come down.
Correct.
But you can't tell someone, hey, it's actually better, even though you can't see it. Trying to mitigate the way that they feel about the price they pay at the grocery store, not a good idea.
Right. And in the 90s and 00s and 010s, inflation was very low by historical standards and something that most people could keep up with. And then we had this big price jump in a 2.5-year period. And it was sort of cushioned for a while by all of the checks that people were sent, which enabled a lot of people actually to have substantial bank balances, at least briefly. But by Election Day yesterday, that money had been spent, basically, for most people with very ordinary incomes. But the prices haven't gone down. And
wages have not kept up.
Correct. And it feeds into a larger long-term change. The most affluent people are way more affluent than they used to be. My favorite example of this is not so much the super rich billionaire class, which is its own exotic world, but sort of upper middle class people. I'm old enough to remember when upper middle class people were more middle than upper in their spending habits. But given what's happened to income distribution and wealth distribution since the 1980s, upper middle class people are now more upper than middle again, as they used to be in the 20s and 1920s. So it's not a criticism of them. It requires more of an active imagination for them to figure out what's going on with sort of lower middle class people who greatly outnumber them, which you see on Election Day.
I wonder if the future for the Democrats is something like Bernie Sanders and his overperformance in 2016, that populist, it's us versus them, which is, you know, surprisingly similar to what Donald Trump was saying.
Right. Although it will not be Bernie Sanders himself.
No, he is too old.
He didn't win re-election, but he is, even by the exotic standards of America today, he is too old.
He's right? A couple years older than Donald Trump at this point.
Right. So, but yes, but the challenge of a message more aimed at those voters, and by the way, it would be a more racially and ethnically inclusive version of that if for the Democrats as they now are. But the point is it would put them in conflict with other kinds of Democrats who are not so oriented in that direction. So one way of putting this, Anna, in the sort of a shorthand that listeners would appreciate, the Democratic Party has to become more Midwestern again, but still progressive. And that is very hard for a party that is dominated by the coasts in terms of fundraising, organization, and other things. By the way, her geography, Vice President Harris, did not help her. In other words, she's a Californian. And so, again, and he, of course, is a New Yorker, but now he's a Floridian. In other words, he did really well in his new home state.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of New Yorkers who have fled the high taxes of New York and moved to Florida. So he fits that profile.
Abortion was on the ballot in a number of states, passing in Missouri. Now, in Florida, it's kind of a unique case. 57% of Floridians voted for more abortion access, but it failed because it had a 60% threshold. So
kind of
an interesting caveat there. But we continue to see what we have seen all along, though. When abortion access is on the ballot, a significant majority vote for it.
Right. And the contrast with Ohio is fascinating because, of course,
almost
the Ohio
same
Republican
exact result.
Party tried to institute that 60%. And if they had, it would have defeated what was adopted in Ohio. So the outcome in Florida is one has to be very careful about what conclusion one draws. A solid majority of Floridians voted to enshrine abortion rights in their state's laws, but it was not adopted because of a supermajority requirement. So it is perilous for Republican politicians in Florida who have to win a majority only to hold public office to conclude that they can be very hostile to abortion and survive politically. So that is a process that's going forward. You know what I mean? There was this is not the last word in Florida. I don't think it's the last word in Ohio either, because I do think the state legislature is interested in the Republicans anyway, some of them in trying again with a different measure. But the way I think of the scope of abortion rights that people will have in various states, it will be the result of a sort of tugging back and forth process until politicians in these states figure out what a majority of the electorate is comfortable with in terms of a spectrum of options. And Florida is just going to keep working on this problem, I suspect.
We have about a minute left. So what is your final takeaway on this election? What do you think we're going to remember 10, 20, 30 years from now? It's a big question for a minute left.
Oh, there are a couple of different things. We've now had two unsuccessful candidates for president, both on the Democratic side, who are women. So one question is, will this make the Democrats more reluctant to try again anytime soon with a candidate who is a woman? I don't know. On the Trump side, what's interesting to me is, in terms of his percentage of the popular vote, it's gone up each time.
And he may actually win it this year.
Right. Correct. And that is very significant because it suggests his quality of campaigning has not gone up. So it suggests that his issues have become more appealing to a majority.
That was David Stebbin, a professor of history and law at The Ohio State University. Thank you, as always.
Thanks, Anna.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.